Welcome to Sabbatical 101. My name is Bethany Walensky, and I'm an associate professor at Michigan State University. I had a life-changing sabbatical, and I'm on a mission to help fellow academics do the same. This podcast is a resource for all things academic sabbaticals. Each episode will provide you with inspiration and insight into the sabbatical planning process, regardless of your institution, discipline, length of sabbatical, or where you plan to sabbatical. I'm so excited to have you along for the ride.
My guest for this episode is Tom Mullett. Tom is a former UK record label manager who turned into a passionate foreign language teacher. Tom took a sabbatical in South America in 2018 and never left. He developed a love for teaching English during his sabbatical, so much so that in 2023, he designed his own accredited TEFL course, and he now trains budding TEFL teachers from around the world. In this episode, we talk about what drove Tom to his sabbatical, how he found purpose during his sabbatical by teaching English, and why he ended up staying in Colombia instead of going back to his previous life in the UK. Now, I know that many of you listening to this are academics, so you may think this episode is not for you. But even though Tom isn't an academic, I really encourage you to listen. There's a lot in this conversation that will resonate with you. Tom's sabbatical gives us a firsthand view of the importance of knowing the purpose of your sabbatical, and it also underscores the importance of developing the elements of your identity that are not connected to your work or career. He also gives some great ideas for thinking about how to find purpose during your sabbatical by teaching English as a foreign language. I hope you'll stick around, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to Sabbatical 101, Tom. I'm so excited to hear more about your sabbatical in South America and how it resulted in a career change for you.
Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, thanks for having me along.
Thanks for being here. I have so many questions about your sabbatical, but first I'm wondering if you can just set the stage for us and tell us, what were you doing before you decided to take a sabbatical, and then what prompted you to take a sabbatical?
Okay, so what I was doing before I took a sabbatical is I was working in the music industry in the UK. You can probably guess from my accent, I'm from the UK. I spent the best part of 7 years working and managing a record label in London. Really, really fun job. Traveled all over Europe, festivals, parties, working with artists in studios. You know, on paper, the dream job. It really was like a great.
It sounds very glamorous.
Yeah, it was a very fun lifestyle. And yeah, I never paid to go into festivals or basically anything. It was very, very good fun. But after 7 years of doing it, I kind of hit that point where I was thinking, like, is this going to be me in 5, 10, 20 years? Can I really be that person that's, you know, walking into festivals at 45, 50 years of age? It didn't feel sustainable anymore. And I felt as well that I had gone directly from university into the creative industries. And despite the fact that you meet lots of interesting people and it is an amazing, kind of fascinating world to be a part of, it is a bubble. And I felt that for my own kind of personal development as a human being, it was kind of important to break free from that and just try something radically, radically different. So a sabbatical was basically the only option, because in my head it was very, very difficult to tear myself away from that world, because effectively my entire identity was tied to that. So a sabbatical was kind of like the natural transition, because I wasn't closing the door on it completely. But in my head, I kind of knew that I was walking away from it. And it was more of actually just kind of like quitting and doing something else than a sabbatical. But the term sabbatical and that mentality was, was how I kind of like managed to crowbar myself out of it.
Yeah. So it's really a career break. It wasn't like, you know, I work with a lot of academics, and in academia, you have a sabbatical where it's kind of built into the system and the expectation, actually contractually, you're often expected to come back. But you quit your job, I'm assuming.
It's not as clear as that, because I did quit my job, but because I had worked for this record label for so long, and I think it came as such a shock to them, there was kind of this semi-unspoken agreement that the door was open, if that made sense. And actually before, I don't know how much they'll appreciate me sharing this, but it's been so many years now, I don't really care. At the point of saying, you know, I'm off, they offered me to be a director of the record label, which I turned down, despite the fact that would have been, you know, a huge step in terms of the career ladder. But, you know, all of these ideas in that kind of you know, that conversation were put forward. Like, look, take 6 months if you feel that you want to come back. They were both very, very supportive of the idea of moving away because, if you know, for the reasons I put forward, I felt that I needed it. But at the same time, they were kind of quite eager to just kind of let me know that there was always that opportunity to go back. So when I left, a part of my brain, as I said, was kind of still like leaning towards either going back to them or going back to the music industry, because with my CV and my experience, at that point, it would have been very easy to walk into another kind of fairly top level job. So, yeah, it's not as clean cut as a sabbatical or clean cut as simply, you know, I'm just throwing it all in and going off to the other side of the world.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that clearly you were valued. And so what they offer you in response to you saying, I need a break, is actually, you know, a higher level position, which on paper would be great, but doesn't really solve the problem that led you to the sabbatical in the first place.
Absolutely not. No, I knew that if I accepted that, it was almost like I was just kind of going to condemn myself to more uncertainty and that kind of constant, should I, shouldn't I, is this right for me? Yeah, it was almost like too good to be true that when the second it came out of their mouths, I was like, No, I don't want
to even think about it. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Don't want to play with that.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, it takes a lot of bravery to be at a point where you're being very, very successful in your career and say, like, no, I need to pump the brakes and figure out, like, where I'm going in this world and what I actually need.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about your sabbatical. You went to South America. What was your plan? How long did you plan to be on sabbatical for? Yeah. Give me all the details.
So I had saved up probably about 9 to 12 months worth of traveling money. And the plan was, when I left the UK, was to come over to South America and backpack, see a bit of the world. And then when the funds got to a point where it wasn't sustainable anymore, look for a job in the creative industry. That was plan A, let's say, when I left the UK. But after about 6 weeks of backpacking, I really got quite bored of that routine and it didn't feel very fulfilling, and the lack of purpose and the lack of just reason to be there in, you know, didn't really matter if I was in a cool city or a quite like rural area. It just didn't feel like I needed to be there. And that kind of bugged me quite a bit. Also, I wasn't particularly fond of like the attitude of a lot of tourists and travelers. The fact that, you know, people didn't really want to speak Spanish or hang out with Colombians or eat Colombian food. It was all about speaking English and eating lasagna, listening to, you know, tech house in a hostel rather than actually getting out there and meet people. And all of that was kind of against my philosophy and reason for coming over to this part of the world in the first place. But fortunately, I was a sensible chap. And the year before my final year at the record label, I got qualified as an English teacher because I knew that, again, just for the way my head works, that it didn't feel so erratic or, you know, crazy, and knowing that I had a plan B tucked away. So after 6 weeks, I decided to just kind of give teaching a go. Mm-hmm. And it really was giving teaching a go. It was just for fun, really. I was just thought this would give me something to do more than anything. Yeah. And I walked into that first, well, I found a job really easily because the demand for English teachers is ridiculous. And within 2 days, I found a job. I picked a school in a really remote part of Colombia where there's absolutely zero tourists. It actually used to be quite a dangerous part of Colombia. Now it's not. So I was really, really off the tourist grid and yeah, just started teaching. And the moment I walked into that first class, it was like this massive breath of fresh air or weight off my shoulders or whatever kind of cliche you want to use. Just, it was just this massive moment and everything clicked. And I, from that point, kind of developed a real kind of fascination for, you know, that the world of teaching.
Oh, that's amazing. It's so interesting that what you thought would be the ideal for your sabbatical, like, let me just backpack and travel. It was fine up until a point, but it sounds like what you really needed was to be kind of grounded in a place, in a community, and know why you were doing this thing. It wasn't enough to just escape. And I think sometimes we get so burned out that that's what we need, is like just an escape, get my mind off of everything. But it sounds like you kind of quickly got that out of your system and needed to have something that was tethering you to a place and giving you purpose. And that was teaching English.
I think one of the comparisons I can make to it is if you're in a really, really busy period and you say like, oh, I just need a day off. And then when you get that day off after about 2 or 3 hours, you're really fidgety and you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And then if you can kind of like extend that over a 6 to 12 month period, I think anyone who is driven, career focused, ambitious, disciplined, the whole list of those kind of great characteristics that a lot of people exhibit, after a while, backpacking is going to go against all of that because you don't have a routine. There is no need to be disciplined. There is no need to have ambition or drive or all of these different things. So even though it sounds like that great, oh, I just need a day off to sit around and do nothing, it actually massively goes against your personality and like life philosophy. So in the context of a sabbatical, I believe productive sabbaticals are the best ways to approach it. I would, even though mine has turned into effectively a new life over here, had I gone back to the creative industries after 12 months, I'm absolutely certain that I would have felt great about that time just because I'd have actually done something with the time rather than just gone to a million different beaches and plazas and statues and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and you mentioned that. It sounds like even as a tourist, you don't have this goal of kind of collecting, you know, Instagram worthy pictures or something, right? It's like you have an ethos of wanting to be in a place and experience culture through real connections, not just like, oh, I saw this, and check it off the list.
Yeah, well, I think there was a degree of pressure on myself because I'd broken away from what was like this amazing world and job and identity and stuff like that. I kind of had this like, this has to be authentic and this has to be, because if I just go and take pictures and go home, a massive part of me is going to think like, what on earth have you just done? You've quit a 7-year career and turned down being a director to go and take loads of pictures in front of stuff. So I felt like I needed this almost like, yeah, just like epic experience. Yeah. Even though it wasn't particularly epic, and at points it was kind of boring because I was in remote areas of Peru, for example, working as an English teacher, didn't have any friends, was still getting to the grips of Spanish, and there was a lot of times where I was kind of just on my own. It was a real life experience, and it was something that really, really, like, I always look back on as like something that led to personal growth rather than just a distraction and having, you know, temporary fleeting fun.
Yeah. And two things that I'm thinking of as you talk about this. Number one is, I feel like that 6-week period of travel was probably necessary. I wonder if you had just kind of jumped right in and said, I need a purpose, I need to be grounded, and kind of gone with that intention. Maybe you needed that time of sort of destabilization to then say, okay, now I kind of know what's going to make me feel good about this time. And so,
absolutely. There's an arc. There's like a curve to all of that experience, because you get on the plane, you arrive, it's all fresh and new, and you get that buzz and that adrenaline. And yeah, the backpacking is the challenge at that point. But it's kind of like things kind of tail off. So absolutely, I needed to be bored or unfulfilled to then go and search for things that kind of made me feel a lot better about what I was doing, for sure.
Yeah. And in a way that you probably couldn't have gotten in London, you probably couldn't have come to that realization just in your normal day-to-day, right? I think there's something about having a break from your routine that kind of helps those new ideas bubble up.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with the job that I had, there was no opportunity to be bored. You know, there were periods of my life where it was like, Friday, go to Prague, next day, go to Berlin, back to the office on, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday nights, I used to present a radio show. And then maybe the next Friday, there would be an event in London that I would go to. If there was a concert of a band I liked during the week, I would be able to get myself free tickets. I mean, when are you bored? When are you able to kind of sit and think like, is this for me? You're in this constant, yeah, it's just like a tidal wave of fun and distraction. But ultimately, it is quite empty. I hate to talk badly about it because it was a great time of my life, but I don't think I'd recommend it to anyone. I think it's a bit much. I don't think we're designed for that level of stimulation.
Yeah. I think there are different seasons. I mean, there are times when I think about the things I did in my 20s, I can't imagine doing in my 40s, right? It's just, I'm a different person than I was, and there are different things.
If I have 2 beers past 8 o'clock tonight, the next day is ruined.
100%. It's such a sad part of getting older, isn't it?
It's over, yeah. I'm an early bedtime type of guy now.
Yeah. The other thing that really stood out to me was you saying that once you settled in the rural area in Colombia, it wasn't all fun and I don't know. I think sometimes we have, like, there are moments of boredom. There are times that it's just mundane, right? Because you settle into a place and it's like, you're just living your life. You have to get your groceries. You have to cook dinner, right? I think sometimes people think sabbaticals need to be super exotic and every moment needs to be sort of fun and exciting. And I'm able to tell my friends how amazing it was. And I think it's really important that we also, when we talk about sabbaticals, we say, actually, a big part of sabbatical is just like having a daily life. And sometimes, like, the people I work with, often they have partners and kids and things that they can't go away for sabbatical. So they're at home and just trying to figure out, how do I make my time at home when I don't have to work feel different than normal? And that's not always super exciting from an outside perspective.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the cause is, whether it's like the motorcycle diaries or Instagram or whatever, but there's a tendency to kind of romanticize these things to the degree of almost destroying them, because then you get into that situation, you think, oh, but this isn't epic, incredible, and I don't feel like I want to write a poem about it. Like, it doesn't actually take you to that point. I mean, here in Colombia, I mean, I've had to do visa applications. I've jumped through more kind of bureaucratic hoops than I think anyone. Like, I mean, it's life. It's day-to-day life. Getting a mortgage over here, I mean, we're slightly further down the line now, but, you know, this idea, like, oh, I went off to live on the other side of the world. Yeah, but I also had to deal with banks and making doctor's appointments, and, you know, there's an issue with the fridge, that kind of stuff. Like, it all comes up. But lots crucially, it wasn't just like a rinse and repeat. And I still, despite the fact that I'm shopping for a fridge because the other one's broken, it does feel like progress because it's in another part of the world. And I've gotten to this point because I made a change.
Yeah. And it sounds like clearly, you know, you intended to go on a sabbatical and come back to kind of your previous life, but you didn't. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that. You stayed in Colombia.
Yeah. I think once I realized that I could do teaching as something that would keep me, like, not just as, like, distracted, but I could really get my teeth into it in terms of a profession. Plus, I was also really, really eager to learn Spanish. And that was why I accepted these jobs off the tourist grid, because I was desperate to do that. So I had those kind of two parallel challenges. It was like every day was an opportunity to get better at Spanish. Every day was an opportunity to get better at teaching. And fortunately, because these things, despite the fact that they're very separate tasks, they do have some kind of cross-pollination in the sense that the language learning benefits your teaching and the teaching benefits your language learning. And I kind of found that the two were actually working quite well in sync with each other. And yeah, just developed a fascination for both and a kind of passion for both. Realized that my personality lends itself quite well to teaching. Found that students really seem to kind of enjoy learning with me, and what I was putting forward tend to resonate. And the way my brain worked in terms of being able to empathize and understand people's issues when it came to learning, partly because of my experience of learning the language. I don't know, all of it kind of just developed into this one massive new passion, in many ways replacing what music was for me. You know, music was my life and everything I talked about and thought about when I was in London. And now over here, I'm deeply fascinated and interested in the learning process and why people get stuck on certain issues and how these languages affect our brains and things like that. So I'm just really lucky to have stumbled on into something that, as I said, just became like passion 2.0.
That's amazing. And you're so passionate about it, in fact, that you didn't stop at teaching. You started a business to train other teachers of English as a foreign language, which is, do you pronounce the acronym TEFL?
TEFL, yeah, Teaching as a Foreign Language. Yeah, that was all, I mean, that was a roller coaster ride in itself because, so very passionate about language teaching. I noticed over here that I felt a lot of teachers were actually quite undercooked going into the classroom for the first time. And I kind of got to that point where I wrongly or rightly felt that I could design a better TEFL course than the one I had taken, which I do believe I have done. But it was turned into a 2-year process of, I swear, my wife nearly left me about 20 times. I was probably the grumpiest person in the world to be around. I really, when I do something, I get not obsessed with it, but I want to do it to the highest possible standard. So this wasn't going to be something that I quickly just put together and put out there and charge people money and go, great, I'm just making money off this. Like, I want this to be regarded as the best. And spent 2 years designing a TEFL course. It's now online, on sale, and I'm training teachers from all over the world, from the UK, US, Venezuela, Italy, India, loads of different teachers from all around the world. And it's just pumping all of that. And I'm up to nearly 8 years now of living and working in Colombia as a teacher. And so much experience kind of being fed through, and it kind of feels like the natural step that you know, the teacher of teachers, as it were. And it just keeps the fire burning in terms of the passion. Just every day, like, I wake up and I'm excited to do what I'm doing.
That's amazing. So how is your daily life? I mean, this is a big question, but thinking back to pre-sabbatical, you were on this constant traveling, going to music festivals, concerts, on the go all the time. How is your daily life different, and sort of how have you, right? It's like a stupid question because I think I know the answer, but also maybe you could help us think a little bit about, I think a lot about what it takes to build a sustainable career when you're someone who's really driven and passionate. And you know, you said you work very intensely to create this TEFL course. But yeah, say a little bit about like the difference and how your career feels now to you.
I think the day-to-day personal habits, it's like day and night. Like in the music industry, it was all about being around people, doing fun and exciting things, staying up way too late, and generally just burning the candle at both ends. Like I did exercise in the UK, but more as of a way of just like, I've got to balance this out kind of thing. It was like, yeah. I have to do that. But it was always trying to find something that was fun or interesting, being around as many people, meeting different people, and all of that really hyper social lifestyle. Here, I quite like spending time on my own. Now I've kind of gotten to the point where I'm quite happy just to either be in the apartment with my wife or just to be on my own. Mm-hmm. I like long distance running because, again, it's just a way for me to get away from all of this. I really don't drink that much anymore, and I'm all about going to bed early and getting up early rather than going to bed late and getting up late. As I said, not so hyper social, despite a country where people are always up for interacting and talking and super family orientated and stuff like that. So yeah, it might be an age thing. There's always that factor to take into account as well. But I also think because I got into a world where, this is the thing I always tell people. When I lived in London and I'd meet someone for the first time and they would say, what do you do? There was almost like this drum roll moment. I would say, I'm the manager of a record label. And then it was like, immediately I became the most interesting person in the room. And there was about 10 to 15 minutes of questioning as a result of it. Yeah. One of the things that slapped me in the face over here, but was really refreshing, is people would say like, what do you do? And I would say, oh, I'm an English teacher. No more questions.
Moving on.
Yeah. Just like, oh, right. And then they'd start talking. And that was like at first, a massive, like, I was like, oh, what do you want to know more? But that was kind of almost like a decompression process, because it was like suddenly I realized that what I was doing in the classroom was of massive benefit to the people and that I was working with, and that was great, and that was all I really needed to care about. Outside of the classroom, I could just be Tom. I wasn't Tom the record label manager, I was just Tom. I don't know, I'm kind of maybe losing the thread here a bit. It wasn't a fundamentally, you know, profound change on just the way I interacted with people, how people interacted with me, the habits, all of that thing. And in terms of being sustainable, providing that you like those new habits and the way you interact and people interact with you, then there's no reason for it not to be sustainable. For me, it feels like, as I said, just a breath of fresh air, this lifestyle compared to the previous.
Yeah. And something important that I think you said is this shift, your identity stopped being so tied to your job. And I think I had this experience too. So I'm an academic, and the past 15 years of my life have been defined by the research that I do and kind of striving to hit these milestones. And when you live in a place where there are tons of professors, you know, and everyone's talking about this, it matters very much. And then we went to France and I would meet people and they're like, basically they wanted to know, how are you living in Bordeaux for like 5 months? What are you doing? And I'd be like, oh, I'm on sabbatical. And they're like, cool. And then maybe they would ask me what I did, but oftentimes people didn't even ask me what I did and they didn't care. And it was a little jarring. That's usually the first thing people ask. And now I have to figure out, am I still an interesting person? Like, who am I when I am separate from my job? And what I found out is that I actually can be an interesting person who has friends that have nothing to do with my job. And it sounds crazy, but at the age of 40, that was like a shocking realization to have, right?
Oh, yeah,
that I'd defined by my career.
Having an interesting job and one that kind of brings influence is like a currency in and of itself, because you walk into a room and it puts a spotlight on you without you even having to do very much. So yeah, taking yourself out of that, I think it's really good for the brain just to go through that, to be reconfigured and go through that process. One thing I would say is that I feel now that I could slot back into the music industry very well, because I would go in almost like low profile under the radar. Yeah. And I would just try to get the things out of it that I liked, which is, I'm still very passionate about music. I still understand music very well and the kind of mechanics behind the industry, but I would not chase the attention, and I probably would just, you know, go to the odd thing here and there in terms of fun, but I wouldn't get swept up in it. I do feel like I could slot back into it at any time quite well, but having gone almost like full circle, it would be a good new version of myself in that industry if it were to ever happen.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that says a lot to what you've learned from this experience and the different perspective you have on work, and that, you know, who knows, right? There could be a Tom 3.0 that is just waiting. I don't know.
Like, I don't think my wife wants to see me go through that process anytime soon after the designing of the TEFL course. I think I passed from like Tom 3 to 7.0 in that process.
She's like, just stability, please. Let's not do anything.
Can you just read a book for 5 minutes, please?
I'm hearing more from prospective clients outside of academia who have talked about wanting to teach English abroad during their sabbatical. So what advice would you give someone who's thinking of doing that?
My advice would absolutely be to do it if they've even got that idea, that kind of seed planted, then absolutely do it. I think one of the big issues and one of the kind of misconceptions associated with teaching English abroad is people think either it's one of two things, volunteer teaching, or I have to go and work in a high school in South Korea and work like 40, 45 hours a week. Actually, turns out that's not the case. And when it comes to the English teaching industry, it's so diverse. There's so many different opportunities out there in terms of places that you can work and the type of student that you can teach. For example, someone that you've spoken to might be interested in teaching, but they think, oh, I don't really want to go and teach kids. You don't have to. One of the things that I always tell people that are studying and training with us is that because English is the language that everyone wants to learn, or on every continent, you can pretty much imagine and carve out your ideal student and then find them and teach them. So I always use these examples, like if you come from like a fitness instructor background and that's what you're interested in, but you just want to take a break from that and go and teach people, but you feel that you would be able to bring some knowledge in and you'd be interested to work with people from that industry, I promise you there's fitness instructors out there that want to learn English. Same goes for cabin crew, data scientists, biotech scientists, physiotherapy, whatever. They are out there. They want to learn English. So if you kind of want to keep one kind of toe in your industry, but be doing something different in terms of routine, there's absolutely no reason why you can't just go, right, for example, in my case, I'm going to go and teach music industry professionals English. They exist. Yeah. They want to learn English. You just have to go and find them. So that would be my first bit of advice, is just understanding just how many options are out there, and don't get put off by the kind of stereotypes / cliches, i.e. it's young kids in China or high school in South Korea, because it's really not the case. And the other bit of advice I would give people is just make sure that you take a decent TEFL course. This is not me trying to advertise my course, just making sure that people go for good ones, because there are bad ones, unfortunately, ones that aren't accredited and were kind of like knocked together in 10 minutes. They're not worth the paper that they're written on. So make sure you investigate and look into the course that you take, because the last thing you want to do is finally decide to take that leap, take a TEFL course, and then when you get to finding a job, people say, well, this isn't valid. That's a big thing that you need to do. But other than that, just go for it, because pretty much every non-English speaking country, there's people that want to learn English.
Okay, that's great. One thing that I'm thinking of then is visa issues. So if one said, oh, I want to go to Estonia and teach English, I mean, do the places that would employ an English teacher help you figure out those logistics, or are you kind of on your own for that?
They help you. They're very aware that they can't have teachers working under the radar in these countries. There are a few places. I mean, here in Colombia, you might get away with maybe a month's teaching kind of, under the table kind of thing. But if you head off to a country like Estonia, where things are a bit more regulated, with it being an EU country, they're almost certainly going to require a visa. If you're an EU citizen, great, because you don't need to worry about that. If you're from the US or Canada or other countries, then they will walk you through the visa process. This is a really well-established industry and concept, and all of that infrastructure is set up. Agencies, visa agencies, all of that is there. And they'll just tell you what's required, and they'll get you set up and away with it. That's been one of the least difficult things that I've come across here. You have to jump through hoops, you have to get your paperwork in order and sit and fill out forms, but it's all fairly straightforward. As much as it's kind of like the first time you do it, it feels very stressful. For these people, they've done it like, dozens, if not hundreds of times. So it's just part of their day-to-day routine. All the schools do that. What we do as well for our graduates as well is I give them an extra bit of support in terms of like what to expect. So when the school comes back and says, we need this, 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 and this, they've already heard that from me and they know what they're talking about.
Well, I've loved hearing about your sabbatical and how it turned into this business. And I know we've kind of gone back and forth between the two, but I will put a link to your website in the show notes so people can check it out and poke around. And I think, I'm sure it's going to raise a lot of new thoughts and ideas for people who hadn't thought about TEFL before, or using that as a way to kind of locate their sabbatical or give purpose to their sabbatical. So the last question I have is whether you have any advice, and I feel like you've already given us a bunch, but any last words of wisdom for someone planning a sabbatical?
Yeah. First off, I would, before the planning a sabbatical, it's the person who is on the cusp of taking but hasn't quite committed to it yet. And it's ask yourself the question, can you live without knowing what it was, what it would have been like? That was the thing that haunted me and was the thing that pushed me over the edge. I was constantly like, oh, am I going to do this? Am I going to do this? And I one day realized, like, I will regret this for the rest of my life if I don't see what's on the other side. Mm. And even though, you know, I was potentially playing with ideas of something a bit more long-term, it was like semi-sabbatical, semi just do something radically different. Yeah, that was the thing that was haunting me the most. So if someone is listening to this and is thinking, oh, I'm not sure if a sabbatical is for me, if you can live with the fact that, you know, you get to the end of your days and you never took that sabbatical and that curiosity doesn't eat away at you, fine. But if you think there's a risk that it might, my advice would just be take the leap for sure. And then in terms of people actually planning a sabbatical, yeah, I just think if you have a personality that sounds like it matches up to what I've described in terms of my experience, look for something productive, look for something that's going to give you purpose, and don't rely on great views and cool looking things to keep you stimulated and interesting over such a long period. 6 weeks is about as much as I think as it lasts, and it really all starts to blur into one. So if there's a risk of that happening, look for something productive. TEFL is one angle, but there are millions of other angles. You just got to think what matches your personality and what you want to achieve and who you like to interact with, because it's all of it's out there. As I said, you just need to know first and foremost what you want from that experience and then where to look for it, because it is out there.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing about your sabbatical.
A pleasure. Thank you again for having me along to chat with you.
I hope you found this episode of Sabbatical 101 helpful and inspirational as you think about your own sabbatical. If you want to read more about sabbaticals or get even more support for planning your own life-changing sabbatical, head over to my website, www.bethanywalensky.com, to read my blog and for more information about my sabbatical coaching program.